Go ahead.
Here.
Amira Althab. Sonia Agarwal.
Here.
Anand.
Here.
Lydia Blue. Lydia Blue.
Here.
Dylan Carson.
Here.
Maishay Kazi. Sakic. Colton Cook.
Oh, he'll be late.
Sarah Thuram. Zora Dara.
Oh, present.
Grace Dorward. Max Ehrlich.
Here.
Armin Farr. Christian Flournoy.
Present.
Ezra Galperin.
Yo.
Isabella Gale. Lawrence Han. Vansh Kakra. Sion Kim.
Here.
Catherine Christopa. Yasmin Masood. Jeffrey Moy.
He's not really crazy. Reasons he's taking semester off.
Ellie Porter.
Here's part of my announcement.
John Purcell. Hayden Spector.
On her way.
Jocelyn Swaggy. Christian Tarla.
Here.
Valencillo. Thor Wagsback.
Oh, here.
Alexander Walters.
Here.
Hayden Watkins.
Here.
Zachary Yabu. Eric Yao.
Here.
Kennedy Young.
Has everyone? Right. Sorry. Cornell University is located on the traditional homelands of the Gaigahono. The Gaigahono are members of the Haudenosaunee Confederacy, an alliance of six sovereign nations with a historic and contemporary presence on this land. The Confederacy precedes the establishment of Cornell University, New York State, and the United States of America. We acknowledge the painful history of Gaigahono dispossession and honor the ongoing connection of Gaigahono people, past and present, to these lands and waters. Please review the December 4th meeting minutes. Yeah. It recognized we can go into debate.
Can the clerk or whoever wrote this provide some clarity as to item four? Like, did you try to write down what I said word for word? I'm like really struggling with this. Sorry.
Valid.
Wait. Is there? Sorry, recognized.
I think I forgot to edit that part. I'll like edit after this.
Okay, that can be recognized as just a clerical error, and they can be passed nonetheless, but if we find more, then we can reject. That's best practice. Lawrence, feel free to pull up a chair. Any further EVP Flournoy?
Motion to approve meeting minutes.
Second.
Their dissent, seeing none, meeting minutes are approved with the note of the clerical error. Okay, recognized.
Motion to edit our agenda to move public hearing slash public comment above presentations and reports.
So, as a motion to suspend the rules and move public hearing and presentation above reports of officers, committees, liaisons, etc., is there a second to that motion? You're seconding? Okay, Representative Yao, second. Is there a dissent? Is there any dissent to that? So the motion was to move public hearings and presentations up in the agenda, but the proper terminology would be a suspension of the rules because the order of items of business in the agenda is solidified in our standing rules. So suspending the rules means suspending the standing rules to reorder the agenda. We have the exact same intent. We're looking at the same document. Yeah. Okay, so there's a second. Is there dissent? Okay, seeing none, we have moved public hearings and presentations above reports, et cetera. Okay, bear with me. We have never done a public hearing in anyone here's memory, so just going with the flow here. Today's public comment period shall be dedicated to the technical issues experienced by members of the Cornell undergraduate community during the fall 2025 election and referendum voting periods. Because this is a structured public comment, the Executive Vice President will be charged with replying to public comment. As with traditional public comment, I will recognize any community member who wishes to speak at this time. Each community member may speak once for up to 3 minutes. Because of the 1 hour listening session with the Code and Procedures Review Committee on our agenda, today's public hearing will end at 5:30 p.m. Are there any members of the public who would who wish to speak in this public hearing? Representative Shakik. Yes, you'll have 3 minutes.
Thank you. I just wanted to state for the record, since it seems like we have no one speaking here from the public, that the reason for that is probably because there was no official communication regarding this hearing or the two technical failures that this referendum undertook and faced regarding, firstly, the error in terms of the presentation and public discussion, public comment period on the referendum, the technical issues we faced there. And then secondly, the emails going to spam and the fact that we're having this hearing at all, as I said in my email earlier, was only published on an Instagram that has 700 followers and not through any official emails that might reach the whole student body. So I think the assembly should be, we should all be ashamed of ourselves that we are saying that this is a public comment when no one heard about it, when we could have easily sent an email to the entire student body. So maybe we could all be better in the future. Thank you.
Thank you for that. One thing that we're trying to make sure to do is obviously get the opinion of the whole student body as much as we can. And just to like let everyone else here know, if anyone ever has any questions about the referendum and they come to you, please direct them towards me. And that can be after this meeting, that can be even later in the semester. But I want to make sure that even if it's not people here today, just anyone in general that ever had any issues, that they are able to reach out so that we can know, so that we can at least try to make sure that this never happens again, because it was something that was very unexpected and changed or possibly changed an outcome that we just weren't aware of. So thank you for the public comment, though.
Is there any further public comment? Okay, seeing none, we'll move to the presentation section of our agenda. Today, we're joined by members of the Code and Procedures Review Committee. Throughout the committee's review of the Student Code of Conduct and Associated Procedures, the committee provides advisory input on the proposed amendments to the code and procedures. Additionally, they have organized listening sessions like this one. The Student Code of Conduct has existed in its current form since late 2020 and has not been reviewed until the 2025-2026 academic year. I will now turn the introduction over to our facilitators. And this listening session will last for approximately 1 hour.
All right, thank you. I forgot. You hear me now, Calendar?
Can you go closer to the mic?
Fine. Can you hear me okay now?
It's a calendar doing too.
Can you hear me out?
Yeah.
Perfect. Thank you. Thank you, Zora, for the kind introduction. And good evening, everyone. Thank you for joining us today. My name is Nicholas Brennan. I am president of the Graduate and Professional Student Assembly, and I'm a third year PhD student in the Department of Physics. I'm also a member of the Code and Procedures Review Committee, and today I'm joined by my colleague, fellow committee member, Jen.
Hi, everybody. My name is Jen Michael. I'm the Senior Director of Student Services in the College of Architecture, Art, and Planning. We're really glad to be here and hear you share your thoughts. As a member of the Code and Procedures Review Committee, we want to begin by sharing a little bit about what our role is.
The Code and Procedures Review Committee was convened to gather feedback and make recommendations regarding the content and structure of the Student Code of Conduct and its associated procedures. We are a non-voting committee, which means our role is to listen, gather input, and share feedback with the committee regarding proposed revisions to the code and the Student Code of and procedures.
It's important to note that this session is not about discussing who holds authority over the code or its procedures. That topic is outside of our scope or our charge. We're here to focus on the recommendations for improvement to the code and the procedures themselves.
If you do, however, have any feedback related to individuals who work in the Office of Student Conduct and Community Standards, or OSCCS for short, we kindly ask that you direct that feedback to the Dean of Students, Marla Love. This session is not the appropriate space for personnel-related concerns.
Here's how we will run today's session. First, we begin with an 11-minute video that provides an overview of the current Student Code of Conduct procedures. And then after the video, we have 50 minutes for suggestions and feedback from all of you.
During the session, our role is to listen and document your feedback, as we've mentioned. We won't be responding to your questions or debating points. Instead, we're here to ensure that your voices are heard and your suggestions are brought back to the committee for consideration. We will take notes, and since we're in an assembly session, we will also have access to the recording that will be given to the committee.
With that, we'd like to now begin with the video presentation, and afterwards, we'll open the floor for your feedback. Thank you again for being here and engaging in the important process.
If you could all put your computer screens down, I know that you can access the code and procedures there, but at least for this portion where that is not necessary, please. You know.
This video provides a general overview of the 2020 Student Code of Conduct and the associated procedures at Cornell University. Let's start by clarifying what we mean by the Student Code of Conduct and the associated procedures. The Student Code of Conduct. The Student Code of Conduct. This video provides a general overview of the 2020 Student Code of Conduct and the associated procedures at Cornell University. Let's start by clarifying what we mean by the Student Code of Conduct and the associated procedures. The Student Code of Conduct, or the code for short, defines prohibited student behavior. This includes, but is not limited to, conduct such as underage alcohol consumption, theft of property, or engaging in hazing. The code applies to all students and student organizations when conduct occurs on campus or on property used for educational purposes. It also applies to student conduct involving university computing and networking resources, from remote locations, online behavior, or any conduct that threatens the university's educational mission or the safety of individuals. You can find the current 2020 Code of Conduct online by scanning the QR code on your screen. Some community conduct is not covered by the code. For example, faculty and staff conduct does not fall under the current code, nor does conduct of Weill Cornell students and students that are not degree seeking. Additionally, some student conduct is covered by alternative processes. Conduct related to academic integrity is addressed through the Code of Academic Integrity. Sexual and related misconduct is addressed through the Cornell Office of Civil Rights, and conduct specific to athletic teams covered by the NCAA is addressed directly through athletics. The procedures, on the other hand, refer to the step-by-step process to resolve a conduct case. The procedures identify the various ways that a case can be resolved to reach a final outcome. The various pathways a case can be resolved will be shared later in this video. You can view the current 2020 procedures using the QR code provided. Together, the code and the procedures establish behavioral expectations and articulate the process to uphold community standards and ensure a safe, fair, and educational environment for all of the campus community. Both the code and the procedures are eligible to be reviewed annually to ensure each remains relevant and effective. The process to do so is outlined in the code. The code and the procedures are administered by the Office of Student Conduct and Community Standards, a department within the Office of the Dean of Students in the Division of Student and Campus Life. This office was created in 2020 to administer the current code and procedures through an educational and restorative student experience that uphold community standards while promoting personal development. The office engages in prevention education and strives to support students navigating conflict in a transparent, fair, and equitable process. Let's now turn to a high-level overview of Cornell's student conduct process under the current code and procedures. This slide depicts a snapshot of the entire process of the procedures. The top boxes reflect the initial assessment of reports, while the bottom section inside the bolded red box are the possible resolution methods under the procedures. Let's zoom in for a better understanding, starting first with the initial assessment. The initial assessment starts when an incident report is submitted to and received by the Office of Student Conduct and Community Standards, followed by the review and assessment of the incident report by staff in that office. From there, there are several potential courses of action. First, no action is taken in situations where the behavior reported is not a violation of the code or there is no respondent identified. Another option is that the report could be referred to a different office. If the report does not rise to the level of a conduct violation, or if the report is required to be addressed by a different office, it will be referred elsewhere. For example, if the report alleges sexual misconduct, it would be referred to the Cornell Office of Civil Rights. If the report involves a Greek life recruitment violation that did not allege alcohol, hazing, or other prohibited conduct under the code, it would be referred to sorority and fraternity life. If it was a minor infraction of residence hall policies that didn't meet the threshold for the code, it would be referred to housing and residence life. For some cases, interim action is taken. The procedures permit the Office of Student Conduct and Community Standards to put in place a range of interim actions, which can include restrictions up to and including full temporary suspensions. Full temporary suspensions broadly prohibit the student from being on campus and from continuing academically. Other forms of temporary suspension allow limited access to campus and the ability to continue academically. Temporary suspension is imposed only when immediate action is necessary to protect the complainant or the university community. All forms of temporary suspension can be appealed to the Vice President for Student and Campus Life or a designee. An additional level of appeal to the provost of the university is available when a full temporary suspension impacts a student's academic continuity. The Office of Student Conduct and Community Standards also completes an ongoing assessment of whether or not the interim action remains necessary and can modify interim actions at any time as appropriate. The initial assessment is also when an intake meeting is held with both the complainant and the respondent, collectively known as the parties. The current code and procedures outlines the role of the Office of Student Conduct and Community Standards to resolve complaints between parties. A complainant can be either an individual who is personally impacted by the behavior reported or a designated complainant. A designated complainant is typically an individual that represents a university department that encountered the alleged violation. The most frequent examples of designated complainants are sorority and fraternity life, housing and residence life, or the Cornell University Police Department. The respondent can be either an individual student or a registered or recognized student organization. If the respondent is a student organization, the president of that organization serves as the representative of the student organization for the purpose of the conduct process. Once we have a complainant and a respondent and the intake has occurred, we move into the resolution process. Let's look now at the possible resolution options under the current procedures. Based on the party's intake, there are three possible ways to resolve the reports that come in. One method of resolution is non-conduct resolution. These are cases that have no outcome of responsibility. Examples of reports that result in non-conduct resolutions include applying the Good Samaritan Protocol, which is a Cornell policy that encourages others to call for help when a student needs assistance from consuming alcohol and other drugs. In non-conduct resolutions, educational conversations around the intent of behavior versus the impact of behavior or warning letters for particular minor offenses, such as possessing a forged identification card or very minor theft at the Cornell bookstore. Another potential pathway is alternative dispute resolution, or ADR. Wherever possible, the Office of Student Conduct and Community Standards tries to explore ADR. ADR is how the majority of conduct cases are resolved. It's important to note that an ADR resolution is completely voluntary and requires both parties to agree to this pathway. This means one party cannot insist on ADR if the other does not want to do it. Therefore, if there is not agreement about pursuing ADR, the matter will be resolved through the third option, a formal complaint. If ADR is mutually agreed upon, there are many possible avenues, including mediation, a restorative justice conference, or others. The ADR options incorporate varying degrees of restorative practices. Another important note is that ADR resolutions are all agreement-based, meaning both parties have to agree on the outcome. If an ADR resolution cannot be reached, the conduct case must then be resolved through the formal complaint process. Overall, the ADR process is the most restorative and the most collaborative way to resolve a conduct case. The third and final option to resolve a complaint is the formal complaint pathway, which involves a full investigation. This is also the resolution method that takes the longest amount of time. There are three ways that a formal complaint can be resolved. First, a formal complaint can be dismissed by the director of the Office of Student Conduct and Community Standards. Examples of a dismissal is when the alleged behavior is not corroborated and therefore there is no violation of the code, or when there's a non-responsive complainant. If the director does dismiss the complainant's formal complaint, the complainant can request a hearing panel to review this decision. The hearing panel can uphold the director's dismissal or reinstate the formal complaint. You'll learn more about the hearing panel process shortly. The formal complaint can also be resolved via alternate resolution, which is not to be confused with alternative dispute resolution mentioned previously. An alternate resolution in the formal complaint process is a negotiated agreement between the complainant and the respondent, and is the most common resolution under the formal complaint pathway. As was the case for alternative dispute resolutions, both parties have to agree to participate in the process, and the ultimate outcome of alternate resolutions. The procedures currently require that all investigations be paused during the alternate resolution process, so that does lengthen the investigation timeline and the total time to resolution. Finally, a formal complaint can be resolved via a hearing. The hearing panel pool is comprised of 55 students, staff, and faculty members within the Cornell community. Five of these individuals are selected from the hearing panel pool to convene for each hearing. The hearing panel reviews the investigative record and report, determines whether the respondent violated the code, and determines the appropriate sanctions, if applicable. The Office of Student Conduct and Community Standards has no influence in the decision made by the hearing panel. A hearing panel decision can be appealed to a three-person review panel. The review panel is selected from the aforementioned hearing panel pool. Again, the Office of Student Conduct and Community Standards has no influence in the decision made by the review panel. Thank you for your interest in the Code of Conduct and Procedures. To learn more or to view copies of the 2020 Code of Conduct and Associated Procedures, please visit scl.cornell.edu or use the QR codes provided. Thank you.
Music lab, the video.
Okay. So do you all have a script to explain the format? Do you like to explain the format? I feel like, Nick, you can explain the format because you did run one of these already.
Sure. Kind of mirroring the format that GPSA took, it'll be a discussion moderated by your chair. And throughout that, we might be asking follow-up questions for our own notes and also for the recording. And so at this time, I would advise people to seek recognition from Zora. We can go from there.
Okay. We'll start with Representative Tekic. Oh, can you speak into the mic so that it's saved on the transcript? Thank you.
So my first question is broadly, I don't know if you're allowed to answer or not. You said you won't be debating anything, but you said the committee does not have any authority, and it's just presenting reports. Who are the reports and suggestions being presented to? Because I'm curious if it'll be presented to President Kotlikoff or Dean Lombardi. I think that's something that important that we should know and understand. Then I have a few questions on who broadly created that video, who's the voiceover in that video, and the rest of my questions are more so on the debate of the actual code of conduct, which we can go into later. I'll let someone else start there.
So they are not, can you answer any questions or no?
Our report goes to Vice President Lombardi. And what he does with it, he'll take it further up. But the committee, whatever we come up with all of the information we've gathered, goes to VP Lombardi. No idea about the video.
Okay. Representative Shidori, we'll go
Hi. So I guess I'll kick things off when it comes to feedback. So first off, thank you guys for taking the time out to do all this. I know there's a lot of stuff about the code and things like that, and a lot of stuff that unfairly comes on to you guys for serving on the committee, but it is something that's important, and I'm glad you guys are taking the time out to do this to students. The first and biggest piece of feedback I have is that this should not be your only listening session done to undergraduate students. I do not think that Cornell's student assembly, I love all you guys, I don't love you guys that much. I don't think this is a fair sample of the undergraduate student population. There's a very set demographic of the type of people, I would say, that seek out student government to begin with. And I don't think that necessarily mirrors the average Cornellian student, nor do I believe that there is really an average Cornell undergraduate student. So I think that for you guys to do proper listening sessions and things like that, it's really important you actually go out into the community and things like that. You may say it's harder, things like that. I think it's really easy to incentivize students with free food, just offer pizza or something, and totally students will happily come out and talk to you about what they think about the code and things like that, maybe in a more casual setting as well, just because I think that there's lots of opinions from lots of different people that do deserve to be heard. With that being said, I think for me, the major piece of feedback I have about the code is that it's not specific enough when it comes to the procedures. We have heard time and time again over the course of the year, a lot of people have come forward to us and showcase when the code doesn't necessarily work out in their favor, even when they necessarily didn't do something wrong. And that's totally okay. I mean, we can't accept that a system's always going to have a 100% success rate when it comes to assigning justice. But I do think it needs to have a 100% success rate when it gives everyone an equal shot at attempting that justice to begin with. Some problems we've heard along the way is that it takes too long. There's not enough intermediate steps in between. And there's just a lack of specification for how students can get help as they go through this very, very lengthy process. That video is great, but it was also really complicated. And I'm supposed to be someone who really cares about this because I'm sitting here and I was yawning as I was going through it. It's a long, lengthy process. It's really, really hard to understand. So there should definitely be someone there to help the student as they're going through this process. Moreover, there has to be specification across every single one of those intermediary steps along the way. One thing I strongly, strongly, strongly recommend the code places is time limits for each step. So a student can then go and understand, hey, I'm in this stage of the code reveal process. I messed up here or there. this is what I should be expecting, and this is when I should be expecting a result back. The most popular complaint I think that we've received as a student body is more often than not, there's just radio silence for far too long. And in situations when there's temporary suspensions, that can be a huge thing. Students lose visas, students lose housing, students lose internship opportunities, full-time job opportunities, because of something they may or may not have done. And they deserve that justice and that full code appeal length process. And I understand that there needs to be time to acquire that data, but it cannot be too much time to the point where students are losing out on their livelihood because of their jobs. Or even in general, like students are forced to take like these plea deals and things like that because they want to just like get the process done with. That's not really fair. And I think that they absolutely should have the right to go out and seek full justice for whatever ended up happening inside. Finally, I think the last thing that just should be done with the code is I think that it should be updated a lot more frequently as well, and there should be an updating mechanism built into the code itself. Like, I don't think that this should be something that's so like set in stone and takes such a long process to be drawn in and out. I think we're seeing the culture of like academics change like every single day. And I know university is like doing a lot of stuff with that, but there has to be an easier way for us to go through and give feedback about the code and update it as it moves along for certain scenarios to come up as well. And I don't think it needs to be this big, long, drawn out committee with a big public hearing process and then a long, drawn out bureaucracy that takes like a year, I think, from start to finish. That's crazy. So definitely things to think about as we're like implementing into the code as well. And I know that some of that responsibility falls on the assemblies, which we should do a better job at, but in general, just things that you guys should be keeping writing when you're keep in mind when you're writing.
Thank you for that. On one of your points, could I just ask clarification on the number of not enough intermediate steps? That was one of your points. Could you clarify or expand on them?
So what I meant by like number of like intermediate steps is like something like we heard stories of like students who like got temporarily suspended and then didn't hear back for like 4 months, which is like way too long. So what I'm saying is that not necessarily like there needs to be like more steps or less steps or things like that. There just needs to be a very clear timeline for when students should hear back. And I understand that timeline should shift per like the events or something like that, but it needs to be super duper clear as well. And just less ambiguous overall in terms of the actual procedure of the application.
Yasmin, we're just going to continue in a clockwise rotation.
I want to start by just echoing like literally everything you just said, Ishan. I completely agree with all of your points and all of your recommendations. I want to especially emphasize this recommendation to make violations more just clear and detailed. I think that there's way too many that are very vague, things like disorderly conduct, things like attempt to violate the code. These are just very vague phrases that I think can be taken and they can be used to make it seem like people violated the student code of conduct when in reality there's like a certain motive behind administrator or an organization wanting that specific student or this specific student organization to be in violation of the code of conduct. And I think we see that a lot with student protest. And so for those reasons, those kinds of vague violations especially, I think need to be looked at very intensely.
Max.
Well, first of all, thank you for coming and speaking with us. And I just want to tell you that if I express any displeasure in the next couple minutes of speaking, it's not directed at you. And I will be probably expressing some displeasure because it's my specialty. So I just want to start by saying that there should be very clearly in the code of conduct special protections for student protesters. At risk of sounding, maybe a little canned, like this is America. And in America, we believe that political speech is especially important. And so that means, in particular, there have been a lot of these, I guess the technical term I learned today is interim actions. A lot of these temporary pro excuse me, temporary suspensions used, and frankly, I think that it should explicitly say in the code that temporary suspensions will not be used for student protesters unless they like actually significantly injure someone or significantly damage university property. Because like, yeah, like if you like, if you like break a bunch of shit, then yeah, fine. Okay. But on top of that, and this is where we're going to start getting into the displeasure, and I apologize. But you know, you started off by talking about how you don't have a vote or whatever it is specifically that you said. And frankly, I think that's part of a pattern with this university's administration. Frankly, I'm discouraged. I'm not confident that they're going to listen to you. I'm not confident that your report won't go into a garbage can in Vice President Lombardi's office, or if he does give it to President Kotlikoff, I'm quite confident it'll go into a garbage can in his office. And we did see, I think it was maybe last week or earlier this week, that President Kotlikoff and the university were named by UN reporters in a complaint about our treatment of people's human rights, specifically protesters. So that sort of ties back into what I said earlier, but it would be nice if they address that, but I don't think that they will.
Technically, that can go in the procedures that the committee has a vote. Anyway, so that can be a note for the procedures. Hayden.
I want to speak about a different angle, and this is coming from someone who was a victim of hazing, and I can tell you that from a personal standpoint and from others who I've heard after like talking to others, first off, this entire process can be very, very scary for somebody. It's very daunting, and reporting is you're basically putting yourself through, you know, months of having to bare your soul and talk about things. My specific case was actually dismissed for lack of evidence, because who goes into, you know, what you think is going to be a fun thing, and then you get hazed, and who's like, oh yeah, I gotta pull out my phone in the middle of hazing, you know, that kind of thing. So I went into this the formal complaint looking for answers, is what was going on, why was this done to me, kind of thing. And when my case was dismissed for lack of evidence, the all the investigation, they spent months doing an investigation, that just disappeared. No one will ever see it. I will never ever find out what exactly happened, why it was done to me, and I'm not the only one. And I tried my hardest to make changes. I mean, I reported it. It was a pre-professional frat, and I reported it to their nationals, and their nationals took action. But the university did not, and I mean, I'm not the only one who was searching, like, who has been, sorry. Sorry, this is a hard topic for me. I'm not the only person who has, you know, gone through this investigation, going through it, thinking this is how I'm going to get my answers, and then just it's not. You don't ever find out, and it's really soul crushing. The other thing is that when the case is dismissed, either for it doesn't rise to the level of hazing, or they didn't have the evidence, there's no action, there's no recourse for the victim. And that's just wrong. There should be something that someone should be able to help them, and there's currently not. Thank you.
Ezra.
Hi. I will also thank you for taking the, sorry for taking the time to meet with us. And I'll echo the earlier point that I think it would be beneficial to have like a town hall style of this meeting. First of all, again, with regards to dragging the process out, kind of speaking both to Hayden and Yasmin and Max's points, it drags it out for both the complainant and the respondent. There's so, you know, and it's distressing in any point at any point, and I do feel that there's a point, you know, even if you did, and some things take longer than others, but I think there's a point where even if you did the worst possible thing, you should have clarity on what's going to happen. I realize that's not always possible, but I think clarity is a big part of this. I do want to touch on student organizations for a second. You know, it would seem to me that the conversation surrounding student organizations, particularly Greek Life, is only about hazing. Obviously, that is a very important and a very big part of it. and it can encapsulate many things. But one thing very, very specifically that I've noticed over the last couple of years, and this does kind of get a bit more into the civil rights end of it, just kind of trying to cover all my bases here, is that like I personally have had many friends who have not been given religious accommodations by their student organizations. You know, obviously there's New York State law, which we have to abide by, which in theory should cover, but the fact is going to a legal level almost is not accessible for everyone. So I think any upcoming code needs to be much more clear about, you know, not just religious accommodations, about like what the expectations for student organizations are. Obviously keep dealing with hazing, improve that, but I think we lose sight of the fact that that's not the only thing that happens.
Representative Carson.
Yeah. Thank you guys again for coming out. I appreciate it. I was just looking at like the procedures earlier today, and I guess I'm not entirely sure if this is correct, but from what I'm reading, it seems like there's kind of some inequities with like being able to get legal advice and support for like parties involved, because it seems like I was reading, it seems like you can get a student code counselor to like support you and talk about the how the student conduct system works, but you can also like get your own legal counsel, but it's not provided for you. So to me, it seems like there's some inequities with people's access to support and the level of support they're getting. And also like a lot of the student codes counselors I was reading are like often law students or graduate students, which is great, but I'm sure they have like a you know a pre I don't know. I'm sure they're pretty busy people, so I don't know how much support, you know, people involved in this process are getting if they're, you know, since the law students, grad students that are supporting them are probably pretty busy and not able to guide them the whole way through this long and somewhat confusing process. So I think it would be nice to have a little more equity in the support that people get from, you know, a counselor, a legal counsel, and make that more equitable.
You can pull up a chair. You're a member of this body. Trustee Abebe, you can speak next.
Hi, thank you guys again so much for coming to speak with us today. This was really informative. I kind of just wanted to share, I guess what I've heard from a lot of students that I had the opportunity of talking to. At least from my perspective, what I understood and what I heard was a lack of transparency as to like who was selected to be on the committee or how current like provisions are going on. And I think when we talk about like building institutional trust with students, a lack of transparency really just breaks that apart before it even begins. So understanding like what does it mean to be transparent with students, and you understand what that means by including students into the conversation. So understanding like whether that's like creating lasting positions as to who is on the code committee, like for every year, so that students know when they're running for positions, like this is a part of my task, and so that other students know who to talk to. Or other measures that can be considered with students in mind too, I think is really, really important. But from many of the conversations that I had, it was just like a lack of transparency that people feel like the administration has, and that breaks any bridge from forming in terms of trusting the code of conduct in itself.
Representative Dorwood.
I have a couple comments just like on things that maybe could be edited or expanded on. So overall, like in the code and in the procedures, one problem I have just overall is a lack of specificity, which was discussed with other people as well. But specifically in like the criteria outlining what some of these behaviors are, it's like for me, under disorderly conduct, violent or threatening behavior, what is violent or threatening to one person? I mean, I feel like that's something that's kind of perceived, and without there being any specific criteria or unreasonably loud or belligerent behavior, to me, those are kind of like opinion based. So just having some like actual outline of what the criteria to meet those things are, I think would be super helpful and allow students to actually remain like within compliance with the code. Then one of the other things that I think that could be worked on, and I personally have a problem with, is in the procedure under temporary suspensions. I think the temporary suspension section needs a lot of work, because it basically is like up to a couple people who gets a temporary suspension, and like one of the major criteria of that is whether like students or the student themselves, student body, needs protection from the person, and it doesn't really outline what that means, and it doesn't outline any criteria for what, you know, if it's a risk to the student body or anything like that, and so I think that definitely should be addressed because that's also once again based on an opinion, and then also the fact that the complaints goes through individuals basically, I think that that should probably be addressed to where each step is multiple people instead of just individuals, because then it doesn't leave it up to one person's opinion. Especially temporary suspensions, this is really important because the suspensions, as we've seen, can be dragged on for just like literally any amount of time. And those can create really lasting effects on someone's education and on their life. And at the end of this whole thing, you realize, oh, well, maybe they didn't do that. Well, the effects have already been made, and there's no nothing that can, you know, ameliorate that at all. And then I also think, wait, let me look. I think also about the alternative resolutions, a lot of people have brought up that it was kind of something that they were forced into, or basically like led into because of like temporary suspensions being held over their head. And so I think there needs to be more criteria also there about, you know, the timeline for alternative resolution. And like throughout this whole thing, there's just a lot of rules for students to follow. Like, you know, when you're allowed to, there's like, let me find it. Like there's a lot of points on the time frame of the investigation and allowing extensions, but not allowing delays to prolong the process and all this. But there's not really any rules for the school, which also I think, you know, we should also have a time frame for the school in this process, not just the student, because it's the only way this process is really equitable at all. So those are just a couple of my thoughts.
Ezra and then Kennedy. Okay, then we'll do Kennedy.
Okay, I wanted to echo a lot of the things already said, but also provide something new, but wanted to make sure I echoed it too, so you guys have an understanding that everything said here is very important as well. I had a comment about the hearing and review board. Like, I have an understanding that the hearing and review board for these cases are appointed on an application basis, and I feel like Ishan made a comment that there's a certain type of person that seeks out student assembly in the same way there's a certain type of person that seeks out like something of that nature as well. And while we might have some backlash, I think that maybe something like structured like a jury duty, a like kind of way in which like it's a random selection of faculty members and students to make sure that there aren't any biases. 'Cause also like it says that if there aren't any applications, then like the hearing and review board will solicit out applications. And with working with student and campus life for a couple of other things, a lot of times student campus life, they solicit people who fit whatever agenda they are trying to accomplish at the moment as well. So I think that taking away applications and taking away the abilities to solicit applications should be something that is emphasized in this review to make sure that like things are fair and it's like a random selection. Even if we might have backlash from students from having to participate, we know that the process would be more fair. And wanted to emphasize Ishan's point about this not being necessarily the best place to have a listening session and like seeking out students. I just wanted to say that like I had like different focus groups seek out organizations I'm a part of too. So like if you have an event and students don't come, it might be good to like message like student organizations that are like representative of like different cultural groups or different things of that nature, and then be like, oh, hi, can we come for the last 15 minutes of your meeting to have a listening session? I found those to be more like, I'm more likely to go to them because it's right after my meeting, and then like most of the time, like administrators come out to us and like they come meet us where we are. So that could be a good way to, seek out and communicate with other students.
Ezra, then Admir.
Kennedy, that's a great idea. I hadn't thought of it. The only thing I will say out is just if we're talking about the time thing, jury selection could take a while just because you could still have to filter out students who might have a bias, but I think it's definitely an idea worth discussing. I ultimately think what a lot of people see saying here boils down to two things. What basically boils down to specificity. I would go so far as to say is maybe we should show this video or something like it to all new students. Because most cases aren't of some major disciplinary action. The fact aren't of some major offense. A lot of the time, people kind of just act a little stupid. So what I think, and if you know what the rules are, you're objectively less likely to break them. Certain things are obvious, but ultimately, whatever I think, whatever the rules end up being, more important than that is that people know what they are.
Unfair.
All right. First, I'd like to thank you guys for coming to listen to us and take our own thoughts and then present it to the committee. I'd also like to thank the rest of the assembly. You guys have all had amazing original ideas and things that I wanted to cover. The first thing I would like to say is that I think that video is a propaganda piece, quite frankly, and I don't think it should be shown to the new students because it's not accurate of what going through that process is like at all. And in fact, they say interim actions are used in some cases and that most are solved through ADR. In 2025, there was an increase of 266.7% in non-contact orders, an increase of 77.7% of privilege restrictions, including non-academic temporary suspensions, and overall entire complete suspensions have tripled since 2022. I think that's important to note, and that video, very clearly lies about that. And then secondly, I think that we need to go back to and kind of look at our organizational history at Cornell and see and examine the conditions in which the code was originally changed in 2020. And already we're doing a far better job because our predecessors on the student assembly back then debated the new code for 5 minutes while all of us are presenting new original ideas on how it should be changed. I think that the code of conduct should be a formulaic, legalistic set of conditions for an interim action and for any kind of punishments or things like that. I think America is founded, like Max said, on the ideas of liberty and justice for all and under the law. I mean, the code of conduct is called a code of conduct, but functionally it acts as a university justice system. And to imagine that your entire life can be destroyed for a place you worked so hard your entire life to get into, and then also you pay money or you have the privilege of having a financial aid, it can be taken away over some petty report. That doesn't happen in the real world outside of this university for criminal offenses sometimes. I don't see why it should happen at this university, especially considering Ezra Cornell founded the university, as a radical, any person, any study. We were the first Ivy League to accept people of color, women, so many other groups. And I think it's sad that we have such a archaic and jingoistic, militaristic code of conduct against the students. I think also, I agree with Representative Young's idea of jury duty. I really like that. I think that's something important that's not discussed enough, is that, like she said, what students don't know is that they can volunteer for these hearing boards. And in fact, the people in charge of that, quite, I mean, anyone who's in it, I've known students in it, and I've known people who've tried to be in it. They specifically go and pick for people unofficially that are more likely to get to pick guilty on both for academic integrity violations and student code of conduct violations. I personally am not against making it a mandatory, random lottery pool for the entire student body. I don't know if the student body would be open to that. Maybe that could be another referendum plan, but I think that would be a really good idea that would bring more equality and justice to the code, just like we have, in our civil and criminal law procedures in the real world. I think also previously something that we should note is that the Office of the Judicial Administrator, which was the campus code of, the judicial system prior to 2020, just, anecdotal evidence is that the code of conduct back then was 79 pages, and it went into depth, and it was very clearly a structured legal document for justice. The current one is 28 pages for the code of conduct. Like everyone has said, if you read it, it's completely incomprehensible, intentionally vague. It goes around in circles. And then the same thing with the student code of conduct procedures, which is 11 pages long. And as some of my constituents have mentioned, there was no procedure for public hearings for organizations. And so they made it up on the fly, with complete unilateral authority in OSCCS. They also denied Cornell alumni the ability to attend any of these hearings, which I think is quite frankly appalling that the school would ask us donations, come May 30th, a few days after you graduate. But if you were part of a student organization that was falsely accused of something, you can't go to the hearing of it. I think that that's ridiculous. And then also on top of that, I think it's important to note that when we had the Office of the Judicial Administrator, the Cornell shared governance bodies, constituent assemblies, had to confirm the employment of the judicial administrator. I think that is something that should come back because, quite frankly, what kind of recourse do we have in a justice system where the director is untouchable effectively and has, in private in many cases expressed, her on LinkedIn publicly, she said, I've learned to care less. In private in hearings, she has said, when asked in the reasoning for, any kind of length of suspension or why she is ignoring students, which it is her job not to ignore them, she gives an answer of, oh, I don't know, I don't care, I just thought of that, which I have primary sources that tell me this. And I think that it's quite ridiculous. And also the investigators, the conduct of the investigators should be examined and how they treat witnesses, because some constituents have told me they have harassed witnesses, they've coerced witnesses. They've told freshmen in some cases, they've given them a sheet, a true or false sheet, and they have said, if you don't answer, if you they'll the respondent, the witness will answer in a way, they'll look at the sheet and then go, the investigators, this is primary evidence, this is in recorded cases in OSCCS's files that this happened. They would have gone, they've said, if you don't change your answers, we can't help you. What? If that happened in the real world, that they would be disbarred. And I think that's quite frankly disgusting that these investigators are coercing and intimidating freshman students who do not know their rights. And the fact that that happened is quite ridiculous. I think also the student code of conduct should remove mandatory minimums. I don't see a point in if we have are having a kind of hearing board where they're judging the guilt of it or and we don't want a judge because if a judge was dedicated with sentencing, it would be, like I said, Christina Liang, the director of the Office of Student Code and Conduct, which, like I said, we have no recourse and has very clearly decided to do whatever she wants. So I think we should also remove mandatory minimums. And I think that's about it for all of my comments. Oh no, I have a few more. I think also it's important to note that the hearing chair exercises a lot of unilateral authority. On paper, it says that they're supposed to be a facilitator and helping, all parties involved, including the hearing board and the respondent and defendant or complainant and the respondent, understand the policies. In practice, that's not what happens. She's on record as having said, I'm not a lawyer, this is not a court of law, which is a true fact, but that is in response to someone who is wants something on the record for an appeal and things like that. And actually, under the Student Code of Conduct procedures, the hearing chair, which is an employee of the university, has the unilateral authority to reject or approve new witnesses, which witnesses get called to a hearing, new evidence, what evidence is presented, and a whole variety of other things. And I think that's quite ridiculous that if you and it's dystopian, it's Orwellian that if you go to a hearing, if you have new evidence, new evidence or new witnesses that you want to call, that they can unilaterally reject it. That's ridiculous. I think that that's something that should be that needs to be changed. I think that's all that I have for now, but I would like to thank you guys for listening, and I'd like to thank the other student assembly members who gave many good ideas as well.
Representative Chaudhuri.
Hi again. Echo all like a lot of that, most of it, pretty much all of it actually. Really, really good stuff. I do want to add kind of on to Vice President Young's idea a little bit more of like the idea behind like jury duty or whatever for the 55 person pool. One other thing I'd like to add is that composition of that pool. Something the video didn't mention is what that composition actually is amongst students versus administrators versus faculty. I think something that's super duper important and something that jury duty really gets right is that they really try to get people who have been placed in similar positions in some way or another as like the defendant right now to be in there. And in a similar way, I think it's really important that you have a certain percentage of composition of students who are actually voting in that position as well. It's really easy to have a pool of people and then to just constantly just pull out administrators or faculty for specific cases or something like that. I think it needs to be taken a step further as well, and to say like, hey, you need a certain percentage of students, faculty, and administrators on every single board to make sure that's just a little bit more fair and even as well. As well as I, on top of that, just talking about this like conversation around like prejudice and like bias and things like that. A lot of people have raised the idea that like in certain cases there's just like one person in charge of everything. There definitely has to be some sort of mechanism in the code to circumvent that, especially in the cases where like an action was taken like quote unquote against a specific person. Like a hypothetical, let's say like I really dislike President Vice President Lombardi for like whatever reason or another, and I decide to go out and I break the student code of conduct, and in that action I do something against President Lombardi. Obviously, he's not going to like me as much, and therefore he's going to have some sort of bias going into that decision-making process as well. And that's completely normal. That's completely human. But I do believe in that case, it's really important for like a third person, like party, to be able to step in and say like, "Hey, that's okay. There is bias on both sides of this issue, and needs to be able to take that action as well." And I think that should be unilateral for all decisions, not just for President Lombardi, but also like Christine Liang or like anyone else who's in that point of power. And similarly, on that same committee, I think there has to be some sort of bias check that's also done for those situations as well, where people should be able to excuse themselves, or people who are advocating for or against the issue should also be able to strike people of that committee for specific biases for or against that student as well, which I think is super important. If a student has, like, let's say a professor that they had, and that professor didn't like them for whatever reason, and that they're on their board, that's a huge problem. And right now, there's no like course of action to be able to say like for or against that as well. So really, just like what everyone else is saying, a lot more specificity, a lot more just like putting yourself in the shoes of a student who's going through like a very like traumatic and like stressful experience. I think like the role of this code should be written in such a way so that we are putting students' needs first, and like innocent above all, and seeing how they can best support them to prove that they didn't do anything wrong.
Hey, Admir.
Yeah, Ishan, that's actually a really good point, and I just wanted to offer some information on that. So under the current code of conduct procedures, your hearing board is supposed to be one faculty member, one staff of Cornell, and then three students. But also provisionally, as some of my constituents have told me, is that there will be instances where Chair Karen Vicks, an employee of the university, or OSCCS Director Christina Liang, another employee of the university, will unilaterally decide to continue with the hearing if one of the hearing members will drop out. So, for example, which has happened before, there are supposed to be five people on the hearing panel board. If you are a student being charged and one of the students can't make it and they can't make it to your hearing, and there's only four people left, two university staff on your hearing board, and then two students, they will go ahead. I also don't think that's fair when that one student can be the person who understands your situation and lead and be the deciding vote. So I think that should be another provision, is that if requested, there should be a full hearing board. And I think also something that there is a few more things that have been brought to my attention is that I think since it's a student code of conduct, well, prior to 2020 and 2021, it was a campus-wide code of conduct. I don't see why university faculty or staff should sit on a hearing board when those same rules don't apply to them. I think if we were to revert back to a campus-wide code of conduct where students would be able to have a legalistic recourse against faculty for any kind of, I mean, faculty might commit these kind of violations of academic procedure or conduct all the time, but they're not included under this code of conduct. I understand the apprehension towards going back to a campus-wide code of conduct, but I think if they decide for it only to apply to students, I don't think that it's fair that faculty and staff get to sit in on and decide the fate of students when that same code doesn't apply to them. And like Kennedy Young, Representative Kennedy Young has said, many of the people were recruited by this board to serve as these so-called jurors have a very, very guilt-leaning bias. And I think there's another thing that I said should say is that the pool of jurors should be recruited by the Office of the Assemblies, like how it was prior to 2021, not OSCCS. I think also regarding interim suspensions, I think there should be a direct, codified, legalistic procedure, as in, anything relating to real-world law, that there needs to be certain conditions met for interim actions, and that they need to be specified that it happened and that there's proof of evidence that it happened. And I think that the interim suspension should go to a university hearing board, not unilaterally decided by the OSCCS director. Thank you.
Max.
Using a different microphone this time. Yay. Okay. So I just want to, thank you, Admir and Ishan, for all of those were great. And shout out to you if you managed to type all of them down. But I just want to concisely say like one thing that I think is really important and sort of puts together what most of what people have said in the last few minutes, which is that as long as the Cornell administration controls this process, students will not trust it. I won't trust it. And I think most of the student body won't, because frankly, I just believe that Michael Kotlikoff will call someone and be like, yo, I just talked to Donald Trump, not Donald Trump directly, but someone from the administration. They want us to, screw over some protesters. Like, honestly, I genuinely believe that something like that has happened before, and I think it will continue to happen if this process is controlled by the administration. So we need them out of it.
Ezra.
The only thing I would say, the only thing I would add, kind of to your point, Representative Cekic, I totally see where you're coming from about like if it doesn't apply to faculty and staff and they shouldn't have a say. The only thing is, I view this process should not favor the complainant, nor should it favor the defendant. I think it needs, you need to put in as much neutrality as possible. And I do think students, and I don't say this to criticize the students, I just say it as a fact. I think students are more biased towards other students. I'm not saying students should be cut out, but I think the best way to avoid bias is to have like a diverse set of people making the decisions. In order to do that, we have to make it accessible to everyone. And there has to be, I guess, something of a vetting process. In any case, I don't know. I like Kennedy's jury idea personally.
Okay, we are coming around to our hour, but if there are any more statements, thoughts. Okay, I'm also on. VP Young.
Okay, I've been taking a lot of thought into what Representative Spector was saying about how her case was dismissed because of lack of evidence. And looking into what is considered evidence as well to me seemed a bit problematic, as it's all like physical evidence as well. And I was looking into like maybe like a mandatory weight, I mean, like a mandatory minimum of consequences for like a certain amount of witnesses. Like if there's like five people who witness an event, but they don't have evidence for it, and by definition the evidence has to be physical material, then there should be like a mandatory like consequence even if evidence is not provided. Because I feel like with even without physical evidence, like verbal testimony should hold weight as well. And like going through the procedures, it doesn't seem like witness testimony holds a lot of weight as much as physical evidence does as well. But I feel like if five people witness the actions of orgs, like I feel like it's okay to have a minimum suspicion of activities for 2 weeks at the very least. Like I feel like it should be some weight to witnesses, or at least like a mandatory weight if there's like a certain amount of witnesses that are there for an event.
Okay, Representative Orwood has spoken the least out of everybody.
I think, like, I agree with Kennedy, but I think it also is a little bit, of a dangerous line because, like, with organizations, it makes more sense because it's not really targeted at one person, and there's not really the chance that it's like not really as big of a chance that it's biased. But if it's like an individual, you could just gather like five of your friends and be like, okay, just say this, and that's like not really a accurate way of like collecting a high enough level of evidence, I think. But I think it's something that definitely needs to be put a lot of thought into, to avoid situations like Cadence where nothing really occurred.
Representative Spector. I would just like to add that also in my specific case, part of what was part of the issue was that some part of the issue is that there were times where the frat would have a ritual that would happen in the dark and no phones would be allowed, like no recording or anything like that. So even if I had like wanted to pull out my phone to record things, that like I wouldn't have been able to at all. So just that just the lack of evidence and just the lack of ability to collect evidence kind of made things difficult. It's the best I can say. But I thank you for taking time to listen to me. I don't really feel like many people at this university has fully like listened to my story and tried to do something to help. So thank you to the I can't even remember who all commented on things here at the assembly, and then you too as well. Representative Carson.
Yeah, just quickly, I think on the especially on the topic of evidence, like, and also like the kind of the unilateral power of the panel chair, and reading that like the panel chair can make all determinations regarding the admissibility, probative value, and prejudicial. Like, they can make all just determinations of the evidence presented. So I feel like that just also seems kind of crazy to me. It's not really how the real world works as well. So I think a little more say with from other people as to what evidence applies and the rules of evidence would be a lot more just.
Adrian.
Yeah, I'd like to thank everyone for speaking because as you guys speak, I'm reminded of more things that people have told me and that I have. So I have more things to say. I think that the standard of evidence should be changed from preponderance of the evidence to beyond reasonable doubt. Because that's quite frankly ridiculous, because like we've established and that the real world legal system, which has been, edited, and it isn't perfect, but it's been edited and changed for hundreds of years in the pursuit of justice, has decided that the evidence standard must be beyond reasonable doubt in cases that might destroy and upend your life. And to be quite frank, when you go to this university, if you were to be suspended, kicked out, or have any kind of reputational damage, or be part of an organization that committed something that it didn't happen, but they were found guilty, and that sticks around with you, that has real world a life lifelong lasting repercussions. And to think that it's on a preponderance of the evidence standard rather than beyond reasonable doubt. And in lay English terms, what that means is that preponderance of the evidence means more likely than not, even if it's 51% chance, rather than almost 100% chance of ha something happening. I think also that it needs to be completely changed the way OSCCS conducts its investigations. You are unable to see the charges levied against you or the evidence presented. They perform a kind of gotcha, mob cartel style of they present you, they say you're interim suspended, there's something that happened against you. They don't tell you any charges, they don't tell you any evidence. And then they ask you, for some organizations, they ask you to tell them what you did. They ask you to admit guilt on the hopes that you'll get a better plea deal. And once again, the plea deal is administered by the university employee, the OSCCS director, Christina Liang. So they do that purposefully to hope that you might admit guilt, give them evidence that they might not have, because you don't ever know what evidence they have or what investigations they've done. I think that needs to be changed. Like in the real world court of law, both sides have the right to see what evidence is presented and what things have been submitted for review, but that's not the case here. I think also, like I mentioned earlier, is you can't ask the witnesses your own questions. First of all, we've established you can't call the witnesses you want. They're approved or denied by a university employee. And then on top of that, you can't even ask them the questions you want. They are submitted to the hearing panel chair, who then brings them in a separate room. They were Karen Vick's employee. She reviews it with the hearing board, and they decide which questions to approve, deny, or edit. And that's completely preposterous. That would never, like, it, both the in the real world, in a real court of law, both the defendant and the complainant and their counsel have the right to ask what questions they want. I think in a legal system, the whole point is to be able to convince if someone's guilty or innocent. If there are institutional, barriers to that, it becomes functionally a kangaroo court, and I think it really needs to be changed.
Can I ask a point of clarification? You said that you would recommend the standard of evidence for all types of hearings be beyond reasonable doubt or specific ones? I just want to get the notes correct.
I think in my view that's a whole other debate that could occur, and I understand both sides, but I think it should be changed at least for any case where the potential, punishment might be suspension or a non-contact order. I mean, honestly, I think it should be broadly changed because whenever it reaches a hearing or an AR, you're more likely than not to get it, a type of punishment. So the fact that if you have this punishment looming over you and the evidence standard is very weak, I think that's completely unfair and unjust. So I think it should be changed almost in all cases.
Okay, any further comment? We're again towards the end of our hour, but if conversation is still flowing. Okay. No, you're all good.
Okay,
Representative Sood.
sorry, just one last minute thing I want to also emphasize that I heard being brought up later. I think Representative Galperin, you said that if I do agree with you to the extent that we should have a hearing board that is a proper representation of campus. But I do think if that's going to be the case, then this should be a campus-wide code of conduct. I think if we're going to have a student code of conduct that only applies for students, it's not fair for administration that carries certain biases to have a hand in it. But yeah, I just wanted to reiterate that point. If a hearing board is going to be comprised of a variety of people on campus, then this code of conduct should apply to a variety of people on campus.
Advan.
And just a quick point on that also, just I want to put it in the record and in the notes to be presented to the committee, is that's not a point we are only making. Some of the points we are making are nitty-gritty things that we've learned through our own experiences. But what we're saying on a campus-wide code of conduct and a return to the old code of conduct has been overwhelmingly over a 90% support rate in the referendum. And I think the administration needs to really, really recognize that and take in that the fact that 90% of Cornell students who voted agreed on something. I think that's amazing. It almost, I don't think it can happen in almost any other case.
Okay, any more points? Okay, seeing none, I think debate is closed.
All right. Thank you, everyone, for your thoughtful contributions today. We really appreciate the time and energy that you've brought to the conversation. Your feedback is essential for helping us to improve the Student Code of Conduct and its procedures in ways that reflect the needs and values of the campus community and here, the undergraduate community. So, thank you.
As a reminder, we'll bring this report back, and your voices are part of the process. We took notes, it's recorded, they'll get all of that documentation.
If you think of anything, additional feedback from today's session, or you'd like to share something in private, you can email codeandprocedure@cornell.edu. That's code singular and spelled out procedure@cornell.edu.
That's it. Thank you very much. Have a great night, and thanks for having us.
Okay, very quickly, we have some business. We have items on the consent calendar, Resolution 22, transferring funds to the Collegiate Readership Program, motion to approve consent calendar items by unanimous consent.
Second.
Is there dissent? Okay, seeing none, consent calendar items are approved. Now moving to reports of officers, committees, and liaisons. Representative Galperin.
Take a wild guess what I'm about to say.
Dining
Standing committee.
does not question mark.
Funny. I don't have the exact That sounded so passive aggressive. I did not mean to. I apologize. All are welcome and encouraged to attend the meeting. I don't have the exact date in front of me, but like if you're interested, you can ask me. Conversations surrounding Trillium are continuing. Yeah.
Representative Chidori.
Hi. So on the note of code of conduct, a lot of people in UA, University of Assembly has been just very, very interested in like writing their own code for like own revision of the code and like actually having drafts submitted to the committee itself, which is something the assemblies have always been allowed to do. It's just that always assemblies are very, very lazy. You don't actually want to take the time out to like go through all that like lengthy like legal.
Wait, actually, GPSA did put together a committee and they did suggest edits. It took them months, but they committed and we haven't done the same.
Good stuff. But if you're interested in that, please, please, please reach out. Also, on that same note, I think we as a body can do a lot more in terms of like actual legislation. And I think we should have a general sentiment that we need to be pushing more stuff out during meetings and things like that. I personally have a lot of things that I would like to work on. I think other people have a lot of things they would want to work on. So if you have an idea, send an email, whatever. I think we should just like write more stuff and do more things as a body. Yeah.
Okay, any further? Oh, Director Gillinson.
This is more of a point of inquiry, but I was wondering the status on the search for a director of ethics,
Oh,
or
that was
whoever
going
headed
in
that
my
committee.
announcements.
Oh, okay, go ahead then. I see the chair.
Okay. So I'll put that in advance of my other announcements. Well, I guess it's just general newsletter announcement. Eric and I have finished just a plain Qualtrics, just like the vacancies, like self-nomination Qualtrics for representative vacancies for Director of Ethics. It'll go out in the next newsletter because that was the general consensus of our last meeting was, self, at least people will self-nominate to bring themselves here in front of us. And then also students helping students will go in the newsletter related to the Gennago flood. EVP Flournoy did talk to the RHD at Gennendigo, and they said that the students are taken care of and that they don't need it, but it'll still go out there. Always a good time to plug the SHS. I'll just continue with my announcements and then can open it up to the other officers. There's now a vacancy for the undergraduate student representative to the faculty library board. If anyone's interested in that, they've been begging me for a student rep, and it doesn't work with my schedule, and it doesn't work with Alex Walters' schedule, and he did this job last semester, and they're not willing to move the meeting times to get a student. So, I will if I'll send out an email with their meeting times to see if anyone's interested. Yes. Yes, the faculty library board has an undergraduate student spot. And also, Jinjo, you might notice that Jinjo is missing today. He's taking the semester off. He got a fancy internship. And so all of a sudden over break. So like good for him. That does mean that I'm going without a chief of staff for the time being. If anyone's interested in filling like doing that job, please text me. And otherwise I'll find somebody, one of you. And the other thing with that is that if I ever like mess up my speaking order or something, that's because I'm doing this myself and I'm not used to doing it myself. Last announcement from me is that SUNY, so State University of New York Student Assembly Advocacy Day is February 4th. That is a Wednesday in 2 weeks. If you would like to go to Albany for the full day, it's Tuesday night, it's been Tuesday night. We have hotel rooms booked with OSGR, so Office of Student Government Relations. Please let me know. OSGR members do get priority, so I'm coordinating that with them, but Student Assembly members are welcome to come. I've never been to an advocacy day. I know Representative Off Top has, but the general idea is advocating for SUNY and SUNY money in the state budget. So that does go towards all public universities and community colleges in the state of New York. That does benefit our campus. Most of Cornell's budget does come from the SUNY system. So it does advantage us and it does benefit us to be there to fight alongside SUNY Student Assembly representatives and SUNY campuses for basic needs access and other things in the state budget. Any, yeah. No, I'll update when I do, if I do, but for the time being, no. Also, Amira is on the planning committee because she's parliamentarian there, so I'm also gonna hand that over if you ever want to talk to her about that. Maybe she has more than I do. Okay, back to reports of officers, committees, and liaisons for anyone other than me. Representative Ehrlich.
Academic Policy Committee does not have a meeting set yet for this semester, but I did want to say I have like a thing I wanna do that'll eventually be a resolution that's gonna be kind of involved, and doesn't require the administration to give us permission, I think. I'll leave you in suspense of exactly what the idea is, but if anyone knows anything about like making like a website. Like, come talk to me. I promise it's a good idea.
Okay, any further reports? Representative Shakik.
Yeah, I know I'm not on any committees or anything, but I just want to say I'm also working on editing the code and the prior code if anyone's interested in like working on that with me, and then we could do it broadly as an assembly. I have a code with edits on it. Come to me and I'll share it with you, and we can talk about it. We'll make like a working group. Also, I just wanted to like plug two resolutions that I'm gonna write. I think I'm gonna write a resolution on making club registration be year wide. Right now it's open from October 11th to like the 22nd or something. I think that's I don't know. I think it should be year wide. You know, I've had so many people come up to me and say like, we don't need the money or anything. We just want a club to be able to reserve rooms on campus and officially meet and then advertise. And the fact that, you know, if you're, for example, senior spring and you want to create like a book club or something or whatever, you can't officially do that through campus groups. I think that's really, really ridiculous, and it kills a lot of amazing clubs that could be born, but then, you know, come whenever they just didn't get it registered in October of fall in like a 10-day period. So if you want to work on that resolution with me, talk to me afterwards. Another resolution that I want to work on is Willard Street Hall is a student union. It doesn't really function like a student union. I think one resolution that I want to do to like kind of change that is the music room over there. Prior to the pandemic, used to be people would play music in it all day, hang out, lounge and chat. Right now, it has quiet hours and people like sit in there and study. Quite frankly, I think that's an inappropriate use of the room. I think I want to write a resolution like, maybe put more instruments in there and get rid of quiet hours. I think Cornell has like 12, 14 libraries or something. You could go to one of those libraries if you want to study or if you want something quiet, not, you know, the student union music room. So that's another resolution I want to work on. And also, I don't know, maybe just throwing it out there, maybe we could get like a student assembly Slack or something so that we could all, you know, communicate. I think I understand everyone's open to informal communication. But I think it'd be open to have like I think it'd be a good idea to have like an official, you know, method of communication or like chats that are like easily accessible. But that's all I wanted to say.
I'm still in the Slack from like 2 years ago.
No. Please
No
no.
one used it.
Okay, no one used that Slack. We don't bring up that Slack. I think that
Yeah,
we can we but the university does support Microsoft Teams, so we could do Teams. But that's I would want to be under the university's infrastructure so that it gets saved. You and Davian use that Slack. Okay, anything else? Any other announcements? Seeing none, we have a very quick appointment of Representative Swaby as Deputy Vice President for DEI. All those in favor? This is Vice President Young's appointment of Representative Swavey as Deputy Vice President DEI. It's a confirmation of an appointment. I guess it doesn't need a vote, but it's more fun. So all those in favor, raise your placards.
Point of inquiry, is this person, are they an ex officio member
Oh,
or
so Representative Swavey is sitting like a few people down from you.
Correct.
No, this is
You
not
want no, no.
this is not an attack. So deputies, for those of you who are new to the assembly, deputies to officers must be represented on the assembly, whether they're voting or ex officio. So this doesn't add any voting power or anything like that. It just allows for an officer to have essentially help with their role.
Thank you for the clarification.
Yeah. Okay, all those in favor, raise your placards. This is a majority, but it's more fun to see. Okay, all those opposed, seeing none, the appointment is confirmed. Thank you all. I call this meeting adjourned at 6:17 p.m.
Yeah. Okay.